Welcome to In the Weeds with Nicole Asquith, exploring the way culture shapes our relationship to the natural world. In this episode, we'll be talking about coyotes again. I just love listening to those howls. If you didn't listen to the last episode, Coyote America, with author Dan Flores, I strongly suggest that you go back and listen to that one first. It'll give you a deeper appreciation for coyotes, I promise. Coyotes remind us that part of being human is to be both predator and prey, that our lives are had at the expense of other lives, whether animal or plant, but also that at the end of the day, our lives are part of something bigger. Coyotes also remind us that the way we treat predators says something about how we understand our place on Earth. The people who lived in what is now the United States before the Europeans arrived admired predators, thought of them as creatures to emulate. The Europeans that migrated here decided that they wanted a world with no top predators at all. And so they went about systematically killing wolves and mountain lions and bears and coyotes. Today we realize that this slaughter came at a real cost, both to our ecosystems and to our experience, to our relationship with the natural world. As we learned in the last episode, coyotes are an interesting case. They're survivors. They have not only survived but thrived in spite of the dramatic efforts to eradicate them. And now they live not only in wilderness areas, but in our suburbs and even in our cities.
Ann had access to some cameras and contacted Mark and I, who both worked at the Gorge at that time, and said, do you want to do a project on coyotes? Does anyone study coyotes in New York City? Does anyone know where they are or what they're doing?
That's Chris Nagy of the Gotham Coyote Project, my guest for this episode. Chris Nagy is a wildlife biologist and director of research and education for Mayanus River Gorge, a nonprofit organization that manages over 1,000 acres in northern Westchester County, New York, and in Stamford, Connecticut, including one of the last stands of old-growth forest in the northern U.S. Mayanus River Gorge supports Chris and other biologists in their work for Gotham Coyote Project that studies coyotes in, you guessed it, New York City. I learned from talking to Chris that one of the challenges coyotes put to us today is how we understand what nature is and where nature is. Here he is talking about a study done by his colleague Ann Toomey.
She recently put out a paper with her students where they ask people, are coyotes part of nature? I don't know how they couldn't be, but some people said no. But more interestingly, they found people said yes, but not here. And these were people primarily in the city. And so there's this mental categorization of human stuff or city stuff and nature stuff, and nature's upstate. And so that's ultimately false. The animals don't see it that way.
Human stuff and nature stuff. Here we go again. But let's get to the interview. I started by asking Chris, how do you study coyotes in New York City?
Well, we started with the cameras, the remote cameras, where it's basically a weatherproof digital camera with an infrared sensor on it. And if something warm moves in front of the camera, it detects some difference in the infrared radiation that's hitting the sensor, and it'll take a picture. We sample all kinds of species, anything bigger than a squirrel that walks in front of the camera will trigger it. The very first fundamental question we want to know about coyotes in the city is, where are they? Mm-hmm. And is that changing over time? You know, are they expanding or not?
And what did you find out?
When we started in 2011, we found them in 3 or 4 parks. And then that, in the Bronx anyway, it expanded to almost, you know, nearly every park we looked. Now, we're selecting parks based on some prior guidelines as to where animals might live. So we can't put cameras on, you know, the middle of the road, or we mm-hmm. can't put them in a park that's just a big lawn and there's tons of people there. They'll steal the camera or whatever. So it's not to say that coyotes live in every single park in the Bronx, but they basically live in every single park in the Bronx that has some amount of woodland in it.
Do you think people are aware that they're there?
Some people are. Most people are not.
Most people are not, I would think. Yeah. They're pretty good at keeping out of sight for the most part, I would think.
Yeah. If you want to make it long term as a coyote, that's what you have to do.
Are they in any of the other boroughs or just the Bronx right now?
We have a few individuals in Queens. Hmm. There was a den in 2016 in Queens, in northern Queens. But for a variety of reasons, it was decided to remove them. One seems to have eluded capture, and he's not really causing any problems. So I think that sort of died down. But people were feeding them, these pups. So there was a pair who lived in this lot that was fenced and completely wooded, and it was about, say, 20 acres or so, I think. And they had a den. And then that lot was turned into a parking lot. And so even during the construction, and then we've seen this before, even in construction areas, I think if there's some little vegetation, the coyotes can deal with that because the human presence there is fairly predictable, and it's during the day. They come at 8, they leave at 5, and so then they can deal with that. But the parking lot was actually a parking lot for LaGuardia Airport, so it was being used by employees, you know, around the clock.
Let me just interrupt to say that for those of you who aren't familiar with the New York area, LaGuardia Airport in Queens is the third largest airport in the New York area, which means it's the 20th busiest airport in the U.S. It serves millions of passengers every year. So just to give you an idea of the kind of density of human activity that these coyotes are dealing with.
And so that caused them, the coyotes, to want to look for somewhere else. And since they already had the pups, they couldn't just go 50 miles and find a new spot. So they were kind of stuck there with the pups. They started being seen regularly by the folks using the parking lot, and they went on to Rikers Island. They went to the water treatment plant nearby and started eating the cat food that people left out for the feral cats. And so it was all these things. And again, some people were scared. Some people were feeding them. And the adults from everyone that I talked to who was actually down there said the adults remained skittish and afraid of people, but the pups were getting more and more comfortable. So when I was asked what they should do, I said, you know, try to get people to stop feeding them and try to just make it to the wintertime, because that area is not going to support 11 coyotes over the winter, and they will disperse. But it was decided that before then, they'd have to be removed.
And removed usually means killing them, right?
It always means killing them.
Right. So can you explain, I mean, I have a little bit of background in this at this point, but can you explain why it is that you can't relocate a coyote?
Yeah, I mean, both for people reasons and animal reasons, it's generally either a bad idea or pointless. Just moving a coyote to somewhere else, they never stay in that place you put them. And then most of the time when they've radio-collared, released coyotes, they bolt back to towards the place that they were removed from and usually don't make it. They'll, in a urban or suburban area, they'll usually get hit by a car.
Yeah.
Also, if you put a coyote in that place, you're disrupting the coyotes that live there.
Right, because they're very territorial. They need
So either that coyote might, you know, take over and oust the residents, or the residents will kill that coyote, or so it's kind of a death sentence for the animal. Potentially, I suppose you could release it someplace where there aren't any coyotes and maybe it makes a home there, but all the evidence says that's not what happens. And so you can either dispatch it humanely or make it run this gauntlet of slow death. But then even from a perspective of just from, you know, the human side or the management side, you're not allowed in New York to just remove native wildlife, which coyotes are considered, because you don't like them. So to get a permit, which you need to remove a coyote, the landowner has to get the permit. The removal contractor has a permit to do this sort of work, but the landowner needs to apply for a permit in New York for specifically that coyote, show evidence of property damage or safety threat, and then they can, once they get that permit, then they can hire a contractor to do it, and that contractor is not allowed to relocate the coyote. They have to dispatch it. So if you hear all of these things, they're either mistaken and doing something illegal on purpose or out of ignorance. So the reason for that, from a kind of a management standpoint, is that if you're not allowed to remove animals that are behaving normally because they have a right to be here and they have certain, you know, protections, then you're removing only problem animals. And you can't relocate a problem animal and make it someone else's problem. So that comes up a lot in the city, because if you get a coyote running down the West Side Highway, it's not a problem, meaning that the animal's not being threatening or anything, but it's certainly something that someone will call the cops. And what do you do? Again, you've caught this animal because it was running down the West Side Highway, but it's not really, the animal isn't aggressive, it's not food conditioned in any way, so it's not a problem animal, but we're not allowed to relocate animals. We're not allowed to trap animals that aren't problems, and we can't relocate animals that are problems. And this animal's not a problem, but we have it in our hands. What do we do with it?
Is this a situation you've encountered?
Not me. I'm glad I'm just a researcher. But the city has to deal with this every so often. If a coyote shows up in Central Park or Battery Park, it's happened. And certainly there's an argument to be made that at some point, you know, it's just not a place for coyotes.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's up to the Parks Department and other city agencies to figure out what their plan is, what that policy is. And they're working on it. They're doing a very good job of trying to figure this out. Because they have been supportive of Gotham Coyote's outlook that urban wildlife isn't an aberration. And it even might be a positive. And so they're looking for ways to make this work. And so coyotes in Pelham Bay Park, an enormous park in the North Bronx, I think most people are okay with. Coyotes in Central Park or Battery Park, the debate,
trickier.
The debate goes on.
Yeah.
And it is a tough question.
So talk to me a little bit about the family structure of coyotes. How are they organized as a group? How does that work?
Depends on the landscape a lot, but fundamentally, you have a pair that's in a territory, and we can call them the resident pair, the resident adults. And they have a litter, if things are going well, they have a litter starting in February, and the pups are born in April, roughly. And they stay in the den. Let me see if I know my math. February, March, April, 60 days. Yeah, and then they stay in the den on milk for 3 weeks or so, and then they're in the den or around the den much longer as both parents now can feed them. And then they're out of the den in the summertime, but they're not going far. And so, like, if we're putting out cameras, that's when we'll start getting pictures of pups. Unless we get lucky and put the camera right near the den, we won't get pictures of pups when they're very young because they're not going very far. But in July, they'll wander much farther and they'll walk in front of our cameras. And they're still much smaller than the adults.
How many pups usually?
Most of the time, by the late summer, we usually see 4 or 5. I don't think many are dying, you know, when they're younger than that, so it's probably around 4 or 5. But there are records of in the teens.
Whoa.
If food is abundant. So then towards the end of the summer or into the fall, the young are basically full-sized. They're still hanging out around with the parents, but you know, the choice has to be made. We're not really sure how they make a choice, but generally their choices are to go, try to find their own territory in the fall. A lot of them seem to, and this is from other evidence, we again, with the cameras, don't specifically see what every individual coyote's doing, but we've observed it, and it's been observed in other places too, that sometimes they'll do a short distance dispersal, just find some spot to sit out the winter. And then in the spring, make a long-distance dispersal, really looking for their own territory. And then, so that's one choice. They could also stay with their parents for the whole winter, and a lot of them do that in the city. When we get a picture of 5 or 6 coyotes together in the middle of the winter and they're all full size, we know that that's the young that are almost a year old. And then we've seen a lot where one of that litter, that first litter, will stay all the way through late spring or even all the way through the summer and even help with the raising of the next litter of their younger siblings. We had one time where the female was killed or disappeared, but we were able to observe the family directly with binoculars and stuff because it was near an open area golf course. And we saw that the father was still around. There was 4 pups, and then there was this older, you know, juvenile male helping babysit the pups.
So the juvenile babysits the pups while the dad goes out and hunts?
Yeah, most of the time, yeah.
Do they usually hunt individually, or do they ever hunt in groups?
Yeah, they do everything.
They do everything.
Just like you were saying, they could do all of it. It depends on what they're eating and what they've learned,
yeah.
You know, strategies for hunting.
So as a result of this annual cycle, what are the times in the year when we're most likely to see them?
To just see them, you could see them all year or hear them.
But it seems, I don't know, just based on experience here, I mean, it feels like there are these kind of bursts sometimes of,
yeah,
of sightings.
So certainly there's patterns like for people calling the DEC about coyotes, and it's usually in the pup-rearing time when the male or both parents are out just trying to feed them.
Right.
So they're busy. You know, if they just had to feed themselves, they go out at night when there's less. But if they've got to feed seven pups or something, then they'll have to be working all day long. So they'll just be out more. And they might be looking in places that they don't normally forage because they've already eaten everything in the place that they normally go. So they just need more food. They're more active. They're running around more. So, yeah, you probably will see them more during that time, which would be, you know, April, May, June. And even somewhat through the summer, but at that point, the pups are mobile too, so they can take them with them. And so if it's rather than, like, they have to go from the den and then they go all the way out to find food and come back and they're just walking more, they can take the whole family with them and stay in one little area.
How big of a territory does a coyote family need?
It's very, very variable, but usually a couple square kilometers in a suburban area is what you're looking at.
It must be difficult for those juveniles to find their own territory, right? I mean, I imagine it gets saturated at a certain point, especially with so many people around.
Yeah, the way coyotes work, and this kind of helps with that whole, you know, why they're so resilient and why our centuries of trying to eradicate them don't work. But one was that high reproductive potential. But the other is if you look at a map of some area and you were somehow able to map the territories of all these resident coyotes, you'd see that most of the area is covered by someone. And then you would lay on top of that, you know, almost intermixed or in the gaps or even overlaid and are a whole other set of what we would call transient coyotes. These are young coyotes that are just kind of waiting for a vacancy. And so if one of those residents dies and the nearby transient is of the correct gender to fill that slot, often that remaining mate will just take the new...
I see.
The newcomer. So there's always this potential very quickly of, you know, if the pairs are
filling
moved,
the gap.
Filling up those slots, yeah. and getting back to business again.
Yeah, yeah. So I've heard that killing coyotes can actually potentially make things worse. I don't know if that's even the right way of putting it, but in the sense that, first of all, you're interfering with a family dynamic. So if you have coyotes that are behaving as normal coyotes and you kill, say, the father or something like that, you don't know exactly what you're setting yourself up for. I've also heard that sometimes they end up producing more offspring. Is there some truth to that? Or
yeah, I've heard that many times. I don't know if there's this literal, like, you know, neurological, physiological response to my parents died, now I'm going to have a bigger litter
the next time.
But, you know, you've released them from some pressure. So, like, if you've got a family group that is staying together, you know, only the ultimate father and mother of all of them are the ones that are breeding. If they're removed, then all the females will, and even the males will try to breed somehow. And they'll go out and try to, you know, so now you've got, rather than one resident pair, you could have all those offspring kind of competing and at least attempting to breed with whatever mate they find. Mm-hmm. And so you may end up with more litters right there.
Overall, okay. Yeah.
It's more, I think more what people report is they eradicate coyotes. So the standard, like, master student project in the South, if you're working in a, you know, a wildlife management school, is measure deer fawn survival, kill as many coyotes as you can, measure deer fawn survival again, and do that a couple of years and see what happens. And time again, fawn survival is X, kill 500 coyotes, fawn survival goes up, and then it quickly comes down, and the coyotes come back in within a few years and start their normal business. It's because of that transient population that's always, like, just ready to fill in any gaps, but also once if you've lowered the density of coyotes, there's less competition, and now there's the ones that are left can handle bigger litters.
And is that the reason they're using
deer as a measure? Is that because they want deer to hunt? Is that?
Yeah, that's where you're funding. Okay. I mean, that's what you're interested in if you're funded by hunting
licenses.
We've
got lots of deer to hunt up here.
Let me step in again here to address the problem of deer briefly. If you're wondering why I'm a bit cavalier on the idea of hunting deer, it's because scientists are learning that the absence of a check on the deer population in recent years is having a devastating effect on the forest ecosystem, at least in the Northeast. In part because deer tend to eat the young saplings, and too many deer make it hard for the forest to regenerate. Not to mention that they tend to prefer native plants, which then allows non-native invasive plants to grow more aggressively. If you're not familiar with the importance of native plants in the ecosystem, I encourage you to listen to my first two episodes with Doug Talamy and Carolyn Summers. Some scientists, Bernd Blossi from Cornell, for example, think that unless we do something about the abundance of deer, we may simply lose our forests in the Northeast altogether, which is hard to imagine. Anyway, where were we?
We've got lots of deer to hunt up here.
It's an interesting dynamic when you go to conferences. The folks from the Northeast and the North in general seem to have all accepted the fact that we have more deer now than basically ever before, and maybe that's too many. And so they sort of look at bears and bobcats and coyotes as like, oh, maybe they could help and do some top-down regulation, or at least we should study it and see. And time again, they come up with the answer, no, not really. Mm. And then seems to me, and this is my bias, and maybe you'll get some emails or something, but down south, they're still in the mindset of maximize ungulate populations because that's what we want for our hunters. And so they want as big a densely, you know, deer across the landscape as possible. And people are worried that coyotes are lowering that to some degree. And they find time and time again that that's the case. So it's sort of like we always find out the bad news.
right, over and over again because, you know, we don't believe it the first time or the second time.
Or I don't know, we're just like, we have this pessimistic outlook that like in the region where we'd sort of like to maybe see some effect of coyotes on deer, we don't find it. And in the place where we'd prefer, hopefully they're not affecting deer, we find it. And I don't know, maybe there's some subconscious thing going on there, but most of the time in our region, certainly coyotes kill fawns, and certainly occurrences of coyotes taking adult deer definitely happen. But from a biologist standpoint, you're looking at, does that change the growth trajectory or the stability of the population? And it really doesn't seem like they're taking a huge chunk.
So we need wolves, basically.
Yeah, I mean, things could change over time. Things could change according to location, conditions. But yeah, I'd much rather. One thing I do at the Gorge, too, is we have a deer management program, and I say I'd much rather run a wolf reintroduction program than a deer management program.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But even then, like, white-tailed deer, you know, evolved with wolves, mountain lions, eastern mountain lions, black bear in abundance, and people, like, there were people here
hunting them
right. And making their living off of that.
Do people in the deer management quote-unquote program does that deer serve as food?
Oh, absolutely. Got to do something. We try to do as much as we can. Everybody takes deer home and for the freezer.
Really?
And you can donate it. In New York they have a pretty good donation
program. Are you good
program.
At cooking venison?
I'm trying my best to learn. I only started hunting for a few years.
Interesting.
And then the rest, we can donate it to the Wolf Center. Scraps and rib cages that people aren't going to bother eating.
Yeah, because they have carcasses. They use roadkill as well, right?
To feed them.
So going back to the coyote again, are there things you've learned about coyotes having this proximity to them, whether it's through cameras or in person, that have surprised you? As an animal to animal, what's your feeling about the coyote at this point? Are there things that surprised you about them?
Yeah, just like seeing, I don't know if it's surprised, but we have this one coyote that's way down in Queens in this tiny little park, and he's been there now for almost 11 years. So I don't know how old he was when he showed up, but he's getting pretty old, but he's still able to just do his thing. Without really bothering anyone. And so you just think, like, how did you even get here? every summer he digs this hole to make a den, and of course there's no females around. So it's kind of sad, but he just motors on and does his thing, and it's a little sad, especially with the den every summer. But it's also, I don't know, you respect the resiliency, as he said, and you know, just like the places they show up. And we have this one family that's one of our most successful, well, until the female disappeared, but this male has been there for several years, and they had 3 or 4 litters, and it's at the edge of this golf course. And so you try to figure out, like, why here? Why is this okay? And maybe over there isn't. And you know, there's just this tiny little strip of vegetation that's not part of the golf course. People are not allowed to go. It backs up against the water. So it's basically, like, very private. And so just that little strip where nobody goes, that's where they put the den. Mm. And then they just stay there all day long. And then night comes and they go out and forage. And we've recently been able to actually put collars on a few of those guys, of that family. And you can see, you know, every half hour it sends you a location. And immediately, like, the world opens up about, you can see what these guys are doing.
Mm.
And they use 3 different parks in the Southeast Bronx, but they never enter the residential neighborhoods. They just walk right along the coast. If you're down in the Bronx or in the city in any coastline, there are these big kind of, they reinforce the coastline often with, you know, giant boulders and kind of make a seawall kind of thing. And they just walk along those to get to all the different places they need to go. Whereas they could just walk through someone's neighborhood and go straight where they want to go. But they take this long meandering route just to avoid people. So they're figuring this out somehow, and they're getting there. And I can't imagine what that's like for an animal.
So in some ways, they're the poster child for how wildlife can survive in a reality where people dominate so much.
I look at it like, you know, if we as a society decide that cities are a place where we want wildlife to also thrive, there are many things you could do to make it easier.
Such
for
as?
Them. Well, just basically allow permitting movement.
Mm-hmm.
So you
corridors.
Corridors, yeah. And first protecting space within the city, mm-hmm. and not only having parks as like giant lawns with playgrounds, but also having forests. And I think people want that.
At this point in the conversation, I asked Chris about hazing. Hazing is a way to signal to coyotes that they should keep away from human-dominated areas, both for our safety and for theirs. I've heard all kinds of suggestions of ways to haze. One I thought was clever was to carry an umbrella that you could pop open if ever a coyote came too close for comfort. But when I talked to Chris about this, he had a more nuanced response. One of the things I like about Chris is that he's never one to give you a pat answer. He thinks like a scientist, grounded in facts. On the subject of hazing, he said, well, it depends. You don't want to do the same thing every time. And to make his point, he told me about a family of coyotes that lives on a golf course in the Bronx that got used to the sound of massive lawnmowers that started up every morning. On the other hand, he said, sometimes a smelly sock can be enough to get coyotes to move their den. Let's pick up the interview again with Chris talking about this dynamic of hazing and habituation.
And I remember you told me about how sensitive they are, but how they can become habituated to certain behaviors.
Right.
So, do you mind just
there's
telling
a lot
us-
of talk about habituation in general with urban wildlife. Like, if you go to Yellowstone, right, and you measure, you know, how close can I walk to a coyote or some other animal before it runs away? That distance will probably be pretty far. If, you know, say 100 yards or something, or 200 yards even. And so if a coyote that lived in the Bronx had that sort of reaction every time a person got within 100 yards, it wouldn't survive. It can't, because there always is a person within 100 yards in most of these places. So the degree to which habituation is necessary and in some ways good, because you don't want a coyote freaking out all the time and running around and trying to flee and possibly, you know, acting defensively or fearfully. So you need habituation if you're going to have animals in the suburbs and the urban areas. But then, of course, you want them to not be within 10 feet of a person. Mm-hmm, you want mm-hmm. them to still have that level of wariness.
So let me interrupt you for a second. What would you do? So we had a situation where I live where there was a coyote that was seen a few times in vicinity of a playground, and people really freaked out about that. What would your advice be in terms of hazing in that kind of situation?
It's really hard for me to give any advice about
being
there.
Okay, you need the particulars.
Yeah, well, I mean, and it sounds like a cop-out, but it is, because I'd have to, I mean, I could tell you the few examples that I have been somewhat involved in and why it's subtle in many ways. But yeah, if you don't like the coyote near the playground, you could try to varying and increasingly abrasive ways to scare it off.
Starting with just shouting or?
Yeah, or, you know, spray it with a hose, paintball guns people use. I'd like to see if you go to the level where you're like hurling projectiles at animals, it should probably be handled by professionals rather than just like a general rule for hikers is to throw crap at animals. But one of the things I would like to get more involved in is these sort of situations, because I've never really experienced anything like some of the stories I hear. And even when I have been available to see these sort of things, it hasn't been as bad as was described, and maybe I just haven't seen it yet. But the animals are always moving away from you if you're looking at them, in my experience. And not to say, clearly, coyote attacks occur and there are problems. So I'm not saying people are lying, but I want to get more experience with that situation so I can advise people better. But, you know, I'm primarily a researcher, and I'm lucky enough not to have to be the person that makes the decision in a given town. But
well, it's clear to me that fear plays a big role in it. And it sounds like a naive question, but there's part of me that just wonders, why are people afraid of coyotes? I'm not sure that the answer is completely simple, you know?
Right, and you need to know what they saw. Was the coyote, you know, just walking by? Or was it, like, staring at the children and for a long period of time? Was it getting too close where, you know, and you'd want to know what time of year it is. You'd want to know if they had a den nearby. I think what happens a lot when you have these problems in the denning season is, you know, like I said, they start choosing a den in February. And a lot of times, especially again in the city, people are not out. So a certain place to a coyote looks nice and abandoned and private. And if it's their first time making a den in that area, they do it. And then April comes and people show up walking their dogs and riding their bikes. And when we've seen that happen and we are able to convince people to maybe stay away from that area until late, you know, mid-June, they will leave. They don't like it either. And then they won't den there again either. They made a mistake and they won't do it. We had a den in an apartment complex in Riverdale. And that sure enough, that happened. Luckily enough, one of our colleagues, Ferdy Yao, who lives in Riverdale and helps us run cameras and all sorts of things, he's in good contact with the managers and the residents of this development, and they asked him what to do, and he said, well, if you can rope the area off until June, they're going to be gone. And sure enough, that's what happened. And then they didn't den there anymore. So you got to look at that, too. Maybe there is a den nearby, and if you can, you know, in a more suburban or rural area, coyotes can often switch dens. In the city, I get a little worried about trying to make coyote switch dens, because that may be the only den that meets their requirements, and they may choose an even worse place if you make them switch. So, but here, even in Westchester, they probably have a couple options. So if you can often get them to switch.
And they don't want you to know where their den is, right? So if they have an indication that you're sniffing around, then.
And it's a short period of time. You know, so like the playground idea, kids are not in the playground in February. It's a nice, quiet place. They put a den there. Then the kids show up in the spring, and now this coyote is stressed and looking at all these apes running around and making noise near its babies.
What do you... So this picture that you painted for us of coexisting with wildlife, even in cities, I find really compelling. But I imagine you occasionally encounter people who are skeptical. Do you have an argument for why it's a good thing to coexist with wildlife, even in more dense areas?
Right. Well, for coyotes, by and large, you don't have a choice.
Well, there's that.
You're not going to eradicate them. We've tried that for a couple centuries now, and we still try it. So that's sort of another thing that we examine in the project. We have Anne has moved on to more, well, she's always was interested in it, but now she studies it, the social aspects or the kind of social, psychological aspects of how humans see nature. And she recently put out a paper with their students where they ask people, are coyotes part of nature? I don't know how they couldn't be, but some people said no. But more interestingly, they found people said yes, but not here. And these were people primarily in the city. And so there's this mental categorization of human stuff or city stuff and nature stuff. And nature's upstate, and there's, mm-hmm. you know. And so that's ultimately false. The animals don't see it that way. Some animals may not want to live in a city environment, but it's not because of some like arbitrary definition of what's supposed to be and not. It's whether the resources are there or not. And so some animals find the resources they want in the city and they just live there. There's no thought about it. So that's kind of the mentality you run up against. Oftentimes we're asked, you know, what good are coyotes? And people will say, well, they eat goose eggs, and goose are often seen as a nuisance or a problem for water quality or poop all over the park and stuff. And then other places, well, they can control mice. And I think those things are wonderful to study and important things to know. But I think sometimes those arguments fail because if I find that the coyotes in Pelham Bay Park aren't eating goose eggs, does that mean that they're worthless? Mm-hmm. So I want to study those things because I'm an ecologist, but to use them as the sole reason as to why we should value wildlife and respect other living things is, I think someday that won't work.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's also not why I do it, right? I like, you know, so if I thought back to my own life, I didn't get into this because I thought, oh, wouldn't it be interesting to learn about how, you know, food web dynamics occur? No, I got into it because I like animals. I think they're awesome and we should respect them.
I hope you enjoyed the episode. Go to our website in-the-weeds.net for lovely pictures of coyotes and links to information on Chris Nagy and the Gotham Coyote Project. You can also follow me on Twitter at InTheWeedsPod. In our next episode, I'll be talking to Christiana Zenner from the Department of Theology at Fordham University about the Pope's encyclical on the environment. Google it. I think you'll find it interesting.